football on Off the Ball.
Mulroney's been nowhere near it. You just look at some of his interviews. He's talking about, I'm starting to catch fire now. I'm starting to feel good again. You know, it's July. Like, what?
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off the Ball Breakfast.
With UPMC Sports Surgery Clinic. When things don't move, rotate or bend like they used to, choose us to help you get back in action.
Delighted to say, Keith is here with me again. How are you, Keith?
I'm great, Will. How are you?
Yeah, good, good. And we got Arthur here as well. How are you, Arthur?
Flying.
Good, good. We were looking through the best headlines that were available around Benjamin Sesko. So he was in his private jet last night on his way from Germany to Manchester to complete his move. Decided not to go to Newcastle, despite the fact they had bid very heavily for him as well. And we decided that the back of the Daily Star have gone with the best headline. They've gone for Sesko Club Card. There are plenty of Tesco puns, but Arthur, you've decided that Sesko Club Card is the best.
I like it. There's a bit of nuance to it. It's, you know, because I don't know how true it was, but I did see reports as well that he's taken less money.
Significantly less money when it comes to wage.
Which is, it's been a rough out few weeks for Newcastle. Like,
I thought that was probably the only appeal of playing for Manchester United at the minute was the financial rewards. And if Sesko's not interested in the financial reward and it seems like he just wants to play for Manchester United, it's a brilliant sign, and if somebody has that bit between their teeth. But when you look at the likes of Mbeumo and Cunha going, you say, why would you go to Manchester United? You understand the wages are massive, but the fact that Sesko's gone and has taken not a wage cut, but probably not as lucrative as it could have been at Newcastle, I'm sure the Manchester United fans are over the moon.
Yeah, similarly in the Mirror, so Sesko, every little helps, which is again the idea that he is taking a smaller wage. So reportedly, Newcastle were willing to pay him the best part of $300,000 a week. This was going to be the big money. Maybe you're thinking partly you got to replace Isak, so they had to go in big when it came to the negotiations. I don't know. Is this about Manchester United's pull as much as the money that they pay, Keith?
It has to be, yeah. I've been baffled by this for a while. I really don't see the lure of Manchester United other than, you know, trebling your wages if you're a Brian Mbeumo or a Cunha going from Wolves or Brentford to Manchester United. But I still think an awful lot of players look at Manchester United as an elite club. I know they finished really, really poorly last season, but I think people are expecting Ruben Amorim and this Manchester United team to click a little bit more, and you know, surely they're going to be minimum top half this season, and should be a little bit more cohesive. Is Sesko the answer? Is he the one? 33 games played last season, 13 goals. I think it's an awful lot of money for somebody who's only scored 13 goals in the Bundesliga. He's 22. His ceiling potential is very, very high, but I don't think he's the ready-made answer. I don't think he's going to go in and score 20 goals this season, next season, and the one after.
So would you have signed, because Arsenal obviously were interested in both players, do you think they've made the right signing with Gyökeres as opposed to Sesko then?
He's
6 years older.
Yeah, I think there's a huge question marks over both players just because they haven't played in the Premier League. They haven't played at this level, but look, Gyökeres, I think he scored 39 goals last season. So if you're going to take a punt on somebody, it has to be somebody like that. But it's a big, big ask. And look, the money, 85 million, Gyökeres, an awful lot of money as well. There is a bit of a gamble there, but there's a real lack of out-and-out centre-forwards. And if you start looking, you know, within the Premier League at the likes of Ollie Watkins or an Isak or trying to get João Pedro out before he went to Chelsea, you're probably in around the 100 million mark anyway. So maybe Sesko at 85 million could be a bargain. Mm. Who knows?
So Arthur, 200 million spent on Manchester United's attack during this window. I remember the tail end of the last calendar year, Jim Radcliffe was on Gary Neville's podcast and said, if I don't sack all these staff members and cut off dinners and cut off the money that's going to former players, Manchester United could run out of cash by Christmas. Was he playing the ultimate trick here?
I don't know. Like, what would have been the end of it? What would have been the end goal?
Maybe it was a case of, I need a new stadium. If the government don't step in and fund my new stadium in the north, I don't know. I mean, maybe he felt that these again. This guy is very successful in business, so I'm not going to question his business acumen. He obviously felt that they had to cut costs, and he felt that, you know, free lunches for the staff is less valuable to him than getting the money on strikers on the pitch.
Yeah.
And it does feel a bit hollow now, doesn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I'd love to know how it all works. I presume it's not all taken from the same pot. Like, I presume there's different, whatever way the money comes in and out. Like, there's not, Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, to be honest with you. Like, that never really rang true anyway, the bankrupt or like thing. Like,
run no cash.
It didn't really make any sense. Like, yeah. It's not, it doesn't, like, it never made
second
sense.
The second tea ladies, when you could just be a little bit more active in the transfer market. I mean, like the likes of Anthony over the last couple of years, an absolute waste of money. And yet they say, oh, well, if we don't spend a couple of quid on the dinners here or there, that'll make up it. Just had to be better in the transfer market for me.
Mm. I do bear in mind as well, Keith, when it comes to this, like on paper, those three sound like a very exciting front three. But I remember how excited people were about Rasmus Højlund and how highly rated he was coming out of Serie A, and he was the right age profile. And again, Joshua Zirkzee was going to come in and be the number 10, and Mason Mount was there, and this is going to take the creative pressure off Bruno. And really, none of the three of them worked out.
Yeah, but I think there's a little bit of a difference here in the fact that Matheus Cunha has been within the Premier League. He's done really, really well at Wolves in a team that predominantly didn't do well. He was a shining light for Wolves. And of course, Brian Mbeumo, 20 plus goals in the Premier League. Again, you can't not see him doing well, because I love Mbeumo. The work rate of him with the goals he provides, the way he gets up and down. Probably not the most technically gifted player in the world, but gives his all. And I think that is more valuable to Manchester United at the minute than, you know, so-called luxury player that will turn up a handful of times. You need somebody who's going to come and do it week in, week out. And Mbeumo, time after time, has been absolutely brilliant for Brentford. So I like the Mbeumo one. I think the Cunha one is one that very, very talented boy. Will he slot in with Ruben Amorim? I'm not too sure, but very, very talented two boys.
So say if you were a Newcastle fan right now, you'd be thinking, Saudi have come in, and this is going to be the good times roll. And then you see what's happened this summer. So almost the PIF have almost gone against them and everything here. So the Elanga money, 8 million of it has found its way back to Manchester United. That's now gone on Cesco. They've bought Darwin Nunez for Al Hilal, which has provided Liverpool with additional funding to get Alexander Isak. And now Newcastle, as opposed to having Ekitike and Isak up front, which would have been the plan at the start of the summer, or Cesco was the backup plan, now it looks like they might end up with Vissa up front and Isak leaving at the end of the window.
Yeah, it's difficult for the Newcastle United fans. Obviously, when the Saudi Arabian money came in, they probably thought, lovely, that's us now, we'll be able to compete at the top table. But there's so many roundabouts and swings that it comes back and gets you in other ways. As we said, the Saudis have probably lined the pockets of Liverpool and Manchester United in this window, which has really stunted Newcastle. Yeah, look, Newcastle fans won't want to hear this, but they don't have the allure. They have all the finances in the world. They can drag players to it. But when does a really, really top European talent, and you look at the likes of Manchester United and you look at Newcastle, Newcastle's a very, you know, you look at it and you think, yeah, they're going places. They're a brilliant, brilliant fan base, brilliant club, massive club. But I still think your average player grew up wanting to play for Manchester United or a Liverpool and Arsenal and possibly even a Manchester City these days. But I don't think many people outside of Newcastle or even Great Britain grow up wanting to play for Newcastle, which Newcastle fans don't want to hear. Although they're huge, not quite on the level of a Manchester United.
It's kind of about kicking to that next level of signing as well, isn't it? So if I think back to, and I hate to use the phrase project, but say when Man City started splashing the cash, they moved to the next level of player pretty quickly. And then Mark Hughes was replaced, and it was a case we need to go to a different level. Here with Newcastle, they were able to get players like Bruno and Tonali and Isak, and they were kind of wave one. The difficult part is probably going to part two, where, you know, people joked, will they go for a Kylian Mbappe or a Dembele? Can they get to that type of level? Reality is, even with Champions League football, it appears they're not going to attract that type of player.
It doesn't seem so. I think they will have to make waves within the Champions League to try and attract the really, really big boys. As we say, the finances are there. But one thing that I like about Newcastle is the likes of a Joe Linton. It was, you know, I don't use these words lightly. He was pretty much a laughing stock a couple of years ago. Newcastle fans didn't want anything to do with him. He was being called the most un-Brazilian player ever. But the way he goes about it now, Jacob Murphy on the wing as well, I think is absolutely brilliant. So it's not like they've just had this influx of transfers and said, right, go and do it now, lads. We'll all hide behind the finances. They've improved players that have already been in the squad. And I think Eddie Howe deserves huge, huge props for that. But yeah, I think if Isak leaves the building, which I'm thinking he will leave at some point, it seems like there is no way coming back. Especially,
so you've played under Eddie Howe, or you had Eddie Howe manage you previously at Burnley. Is he the guy to turn the situation around? Like, is telling Isak not to come to a party and miss out on a barbecue the way to actually win him back round?
No, it's not. And it's not just the, if you want to discipline the player, that's fine. You know, he went and trained at Real Sociedad, his old club, I believe. Newcastle and Eddie Howe found out through the media that he was training there. I understand that's not the most professional thing, but when you tell the player, apparently the 2 days off, they flew back from Seoul on Monday, the 2 days off reported on the Wednesday, and they trained Wednesday morning. Then Eddie Howe told the Newcastle players, bring your family, bring your kids, we'll all have a bit of a barbecue after. But he told Alexander Isak to not bother turning up until everybody else has left the building, and then he can use the facility. So you haven't just disciplined Alexander Isak, you told his family not to bother coming to the training ground for the family day. And when the player has basically said he wants to leave for Liverpool, and the manager now is disciplining and making him train by himself, I think he needs a little bit more finesse in this one, Eddie Howe. I don't think he can just slap him on the wrist and think, oh, well, if he shows a good attitude, we'll bring him back in. The player has said he wants to leave, and if it keeps going like this, he will leave. And the one thing that Newcastle can't allow to happen is for the season to start, the transfer window to shut, and Isak still to be in the building and training by himself, because you can't have an asset worth 110 million not playing. And if he's not happy, you know, it's not going to be a place that he wants to be. So I do see him leaving, and Liverpool hold all the cards because they've had 110 million rejected already. Mm. And the player looks very, very unsettled at the minute. So I imagine he will leave, but Liverpool will be sitting tight thinking it's 110 million or nothing.
That bit of finesse, did Howe and Tindall have that when you were working with them?
They didn't, no. No, look, I always mess and I joke about these things. I was an absolute nightmare to manage. The drink had a massive, massive hold on me. So I was very, very unique, but Eddie Howe had very little man management skills. And again, I go back to, I think Eddie Howe was probably mid to late 30s. So quite a young man still at the time. And as I say, I was a nightmare to try and manage. But yeah, there was never any sort of man management he did to me on a one-to-one basis where I thought, okay, I can see what he was doing with this. It was basically, well, you've annoyed me, go and run and train by yourself and we'll see what happens after this. And I never felt there was a way back for me.
Was there any attempt made in that? Like, did he come in and have an idea of what you were like and therefore you were off to one side?
No, I remember I met him as before I trained. He'd done his due diligence on me. He wanted good characters in the build and not just good players. So I lied to him. I convinced him I was a good character and he ended up signing me anyway. And I remember I played for Ireland in the summer. I reported to Burnley for pre-season. As I got to the training ground on the Monday, I hadn't met the rest of me new Burnley players. And as I walked onto the training ground, I got about 10 yards away from Eddie Howe and he just pointed to another pitch and said, you're over there running me. I rang my agent later that night and said, it feels a bit cold in here. Like I don't really feel wanted. And he said, look, I'm sorry to hear the rumours that it was the chairman that wanted you in the club. So from minute one, I never felt welcome. And I think about 3 days later, he brought Junior Stanislas in on loan from Bournemouth, who was another left winger. So yeah, I never really felt welcome. I thought the man management skills were quite low, and Jason Tindall and Eddie Howe, JT would give you one message, Eddie Howe would give you another message. And yeah, I just thought it was a little bit all over the place. But you would imagine with what they've been through now, how long they've been together, they've sharpened up a little bit on that.
Yeah, we'll talk to Jasmine Han about Ter Stegen, who's in this weird situation at Barcelona as well, where he's been stripped of the captaincy and he's out for months and it looks like he's not going to play until the World Cup at club level. And that gets really, really messy. Like, if you're in a player situation there, obviously, you realise very quickly, this guy does not fancy me here. Mm. Are you straight away saying to your agent, yeah, get me a move?
No. You see, it was so strange because initially I didn't want to leave Preston. I've said that out loud. Preston came to me and said, look, we need the money, we need the finances, so we're going to sell you. And I had very little say in it. I had my daughter in the area as well. So the fact that I was leaving from Preston to Burnley in the locality, I was quite happy to stay in the locality. But I signed a 3-year deal. And honestly, after about 2 weeks, I knew that this is not the place for me. And yeah, it was basically to do with the manager. It was the training sessions. And it was just, you know, you'd be doing crossing and finishing, and I'd be the midfielder that was fizzing balls out to the wingers rather than the one that was crossing the ball. And when you're a left winger, that's not the place you want to be. So never felt any sort of love, just felt like it was a grind from minute one. And before I knew it, I was in exile playing, training with the reserves and by myself when the Burnley lads had left the building.
That sounds insanely cold, doesn't it? Like, I remember Damien Delaney telling the story in here before that he arrives in when Frank de Boer has come in and basically his gear has been moved to the under-23 training centre. So it wasn't even a case of he got a chance to talk to the manager and convince him that actually I could be an asset here. It was like, you were no longer part of the Crystal Palace first team, go train with the 23s. Like, we kind of, I would think, like, when it's an asset on the pitch and these players are really, really valuable, that, you know, you'd want to get the most out of them. But if a manager comes in and doesn't fancy you, it sounds like you're gone.
I suppose it is just that cutthroat, though. Mm. Like, it's not really, it is interesting, because it's even interesting the, again, I know it's all only reports, so it's not like he's come out and said he's done this exclusively himself, but like, even the Amarim thing with the lads that he's just cut adrift and say, right, you're not part of it, even though they're, I mean, a conservative thing, like, there was like 750 to a million a week being paid out to those boys in wages. So if you think that if it can happen to them, I mean, it can happen to anyone. And it's just, I don't know, it's a very strange kind of dynamic. Because as you're saying, like, I suppose, the value thing is interesting, but there's no way probably you're keeping 20-odd people. You can't pretend to the world that 20-odd people are all playing well. Mm. And only 11 or so playing. Like, I suppose there's maybe a... Because I know, like, from your experience then, obviously, Keith, like, Sean Dyche, that there's, like, there's ways of making people feel good.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's there's ways of being nice to people, but I don't know, like, it's an interesting balance to strike, because I suppose, I presume at some point you have to kind of make judgment calls, but the De Boer one, now that sounds, I hadn't heard that before, that sounds... it sounds a bit...
the way Damien tells the story, it was not De Boer who informed him about this. He arrived in, it was like the kit man had said, your gear has been moved down to the 23 complex. Mm. You're off, basically.
What is that? When you say you're training with the 23s, your reserves, what's your day-to-day? Because obviously you're not a reserve player as such. Or you know you're not. You've been like, you know, you're not necessarily punished, but you're down there.
Oh, it's a punishment.
Yeah.
It definitely
what's your
feels
day-to-day
like a punishment.
Like?
I honestly can't remember my day-to-day, but I remember Eddie Howe saying, look, you don't deal with me anymore. You don't deal with Tyndall. You deal with the under-23s manager. If you need a day off, if you need this, if you need that, deal with the 23s. And basically I was told not to have dinner with the first team squad, although thankfully he let me stay in the first team dressing room, so I was in and around the first team players, but I would just go a different way as we walked out to training. And do you know what the worst thing was? I can't remember the reserve team manager's name, but I remember him pulling me and saying, look, Keith, there's young professionals in this team and we're trying to get them to train the right way. If you come here and just, you know, act like you're not bothered and don't run and don't move, they're looking at you as an Irish international thinking, well, that's what we'll try and like, just go and do it right for me, please. And I just remember thinking, what an awkward position he's in right now. Because look, I ran around, I did me little bit, I tried my best not to completely mess up the training sessions, but yeah, and like when you're a first team player, you've been a first team player. I was an Irish international at the time as well, training with the under 23s, and knowing there's no game coming up, it's a horrible, horrible place to be. But look at Enzo Maresca with Chelsea last year. He came in and just cut adrift all the players. But you don't want to feel you have a chance of playing if you don't. If you don't have a chance of playing, I'd rather be told you're not playing and that's it and deal with it from there. You don't want to be in this, oh, well, if you do this and do that, then maybe you will, but really it's not there. So, I'd rather a manager just be black and white. This is what it is and this is what it isn't. And at least you know where you stand then.
Because like in theory, if you go to the reserves, right, and you're thinking, if I train really well, maybe they report back and say, hey, you know what, Eddie, he's actually applied himself really well and you're back in the first team dressing.
You know, the reserve team manager, you would obviously assume that the reserve team manager told me that, look, Keith, Eddie has told me to tell him when you haven't trained well.
Right.
That's what he was told. Report when Keith doesn't train well and we'll punish him. did not care if I trained well. So the message is where you're not playing. No matter what you do, you're not playing. And thankfully, I ended up getting a bit of a loan move to Sheffield Wednesday. But that was right at the end of the season. And within that season, Eddie Howe actually asked me to just leave.
Right.
I played a game for the reserves. I was after being in Marbella for 3 days. I got badly sunburned and I got a phone call while I was over there as an under-23s player. Listen, Keith, there's a bit of a behind closed doors reserve team game. You're playing in it. My reply was, I'm in Marbella. He said, I couldn't care less. Get home. And I played 45 minutes. I was absolutely shocked and stunk the place out. And he took me off and put his arm around me and said, look, just leave. Mm. And I said, well, I've got a 2.5 year deal. If you give me my money, I'll leave. And no, it just never happened. So time after time after time, there was never an arm around me or, you know, you might get back into the first team. It was just leave. There was never any sort of love there, but.
So yeah. I'm doing the timeline in my head here, right? So you mentioned the Carling Nations Cup, Ireland's last trophy. Was Trapattoni still manager at the time?
Yeah, all my caps were on that trap, so yeah, he must have been the manager.
Did he talk to you and go, what are you doing with the 23s over there? Or did Trapattoni, Because I often wonder, did Trapattoni kind of manage at that micro level?
The only thing Trapattoni ever said to me, Preston had just been relegated into League One, and I think, yeah, it was the Carling Cup of Nations. I was flirting with going to Burnley, and he took me aside. We went to do a warm up. He took me aside, and in broken English, he said, "You must leave this pub, Tim." Talking about Preston North End. And by the way, Sean St. Ledger was playing for Preston and Ireland at the time, but that was what he said in broken English: "You must leave this pub, Tim." And yeah, I got the move to Burnley, but didn't end up too well.
Did you get on with him?
With Trap?
Yeah.
Absolutely loved him. Absolutely loved him. See, there was, again, it's just like this going to turn into the Keith Tracy show. When I played for the under-21s, me and Don Givens had fell out, me being, you know, a little bit awkward as I am. He sat me down and said, "You're never going to play for Ireland. I'm going to speak to Giovanni, tell him what you're all about, and you will never play for Ireland again." And a month later, the phone rang from Tardelli telling me I was been picked for the first team. But thankfully, you know, to use the word foreigners, they were two Italian guys that did things their own way. If that had been somebody that had been within the FEI for a long time, then possibly I wouldn't ever played for Ireland. Thankfully, Giovanni got me in and you know, had a look at me himself. He didn't listen to other people, and I never fell out with one of the few managers I'd ever fell out with. But yeah, very, very hard guy to fall out with.
You indulge me for a second when you say you were awkward to deal with. What does that mean?
Drunk most of the time.
Okay.
So yeah.
As in, like, even turn up for training and stuff like that?
If we had a game on a Saturday, I wouldn't be drunk on the Friday. It'd be a Tuesday, a Wednesday night, sluggish on the Thursday, still a bit not right on the Friday, and then Saturday I'd be back at it after the game. It was, yeah, I caught the back end of a drinking school in Blackburn, but again, there was nobody put a gun to my head and made me do these things. It was all my own doing.
No, I totally take the personal responsibility on that, but did any of the clubs try and actually get you help around that?
Eddie Howe did, to be fair. But again, you have to be in a place where you want help. He sat me down and asked me to go down to Tony Adams' Sporting Chance. I remember if Sean Dyche asked me to move in with him. He lives down in Watford, but he asked me to move into an apartment with him in Burnley, which is the most intimidating thing ever. So I refused that. But yeah, I wasn't in a place where I needed help or I wanted help, but I needed help. So yeah, no, there was the odd olive branch to try and help me. But when it's within the club, you always feel that I don't want to show weakness. I don't want to admit to anything because you're telling it to a manager. And when there's so many other left wingers and right wingers that could possibly get ahead of you, you don't want to show any type of weakness.
Yeah, of course. And like you're in a group of lads as well, yeah. Ultimately.
Exactly. And I know football has moved on and the landscape is constantly changing, but back then, you know, there was no weakness shown. There was no way I'm struggling a bit with drink or I'm struggling a bit with depression. It was just get your head down the train and deal with it.
One thing. I know you've worked with a lot of different people, but you know with Trapattoni, obviously probably the highest achiever in football. Would you've come across, like, in terms of like European Cup winner,
yeah,
loads of Serie A, like, is there anything in the way he was operating that was different, or that you can see it's like, oh, this way this guy
The stories he would tell. Like, I only got 6 caps for Ireland. I was in, honestly, probably, I don't know, about 25 squads altogether. I turned up all the time, but because I was playing for Preston in the Championship at the time, I was really, really valuable to them. I was the standout player. I was the one scoring the goal. So every time an international would roll around, Preston would be like, "Oh, that hamstring doesn't look great. You know, maybe you should take this off." And I would always turn up to Ireland with a scan saying, "My hamstring's not great," because I wasn't like Damien Duff was there. There was a lot of other wingers there. So I was a fringe player for Ireland. I was more important for Preston. And I would turn up with little things here or there. And I would go to see Trapattoni and he'd say, "Okay, you have a little tear in your hamstring. I had this. I played with this in this final and that final." You think, my God, he's been around. He just had a story for everything. And he basically told me, "Look, we don't need you to be 100%. If you're 80%, professional players play at 80%. And it was just just opening my eyes to the levels in the game and what he's done. Even Tardelli, going through what he's done in his career. Unbelievable stuff.
Yeah. If he was got a chance, some of the lads that played for Athlone Town against Milan, and they were saying that, like, Trapattoni was a hardy book.
Yeah.
He said those Milan guys came in, like, it was a fairly fancy team. They go into St. Mel's and Athlone, which is, like, in the middle of, like, a working class estate, and they thought, "We're going to give these guys a bit of a kick," and Arnie Trapattoni could look after himself.
Ah, yeah. He used to jog from the hotel in Portmarnock to the training ground. Probably only a 15, 20 minute jog, but he was a good age. And we'd all be on the bus waiting, and then you just see Trap going, and you'd be, "All right, we're off." And Yeah, no, fair play. I was absolutely in awe of, and I remember, again, I was injured for Ireland, and they sent me to Kappa Hospital to get a scan, and there was something wrong with Trapattoni. I think he had a bad neck or something, so me and him ended up going for a scan, and he fell asleep on my shoulder in the car. He just fell asleep, and I remember looking at him thinking, what an absolute legend. And I've all the time in the war for Giovanni. He was really, really good with me.
Class. Andy Moran as well. So we got the back of the Irish Independent here. And this is Colm Key's story, which is that Moran is now the favourite to take over from Kevin McStay as his successor in Mayo. The former All-Star forward is being tipped to be appointed. And it looks like we might need a new pundit potentially, because Colm Boyle is being linked potentially with the position as well.
Ah, Jesus.
I know, it's all you need, isn't it? Yeah, may include his former Mayo colleague Colm Boyle, so we're hoping not. But look, he's built up a CV here between Leitrim, between what he did with the Monaghan forwards in the year just gone by as well. We wonder, because obviously plenty of candidates and former Mayo people who are out coaching elsewhere at the moment, but it looks like the move is happening for Andy Moran now.
Yeah. I mean, it's not. It was a matter of when. Mm. So like as soon as he's kind of went into this and he's taken it seriously, and you can see the way he's approaching it, he's had kind of great, an amazing reputation, amazing playing career. So it's not, it's you hope it's just, it's really interesting, because even for Kevin McStay, there was that kind of feeling when he got it, that not that it was too late, but he'd been courting it for so long, and maybe it obviously didn't go as he'd wanted it to go, and he'd had such great success with Roscommon and everything else. But this is kind of, you just hope that if the time is all right for him, and I'd say this because it's obviously a massive job. Now, he'll be more familiar than most with like the pressures of it. He'll know everything that's coming. He'll seek out, I'm sure he'll talk to James Horn, Stephen Rochford, all these guys, find out, pick the brains of everyone he can. But like, it's just, it's such a behemoth there. Like, when you think it's the biggest thing by a million miles in that county. So it's a massive, massive job, and it's a tough job because it's very hard to be coming off the last decade and have a fair estimation of what success looks like. Like, that's a guy that's played in 6-7 All-Irelands, maybe. You probably wouldn't say that in the next 2-3 years Mayo should be getting back to All-Ireland finals. So it's like, what does success look like when he comes in, and how does he manage that and measure that? But if, you know, if he comes back in, I wouldn't be totally surprised if he had Killian O'Connor back in with him. Yeah. If he returned.
Listen to Killian recently, he was very clear that he's not retired, firstly.
Yeah.
And it was also kind of like, well, I just left it up in the air.
I think he'd come back. I think he'd get another year out of Aidan O'Shea. You'd kind of have that. Yeah, it's a very exciting move. I'd really, really want it to go well for him as well. It'd be brilliant. And it's amazing. It's such a great catalogue of managers now there as well. If you think about it from the point of view where you could have, I suppose, Eamon O'Hara and Desi Sloane in Sligo, Pádraig Joyce in Galway, Andy Moran in Mayo. It's just, it's amazing. Like, it's amazing how the generation goes on from watching all these guys to kind of being like, they're just
iconic legends across the board for next year. Yeah, I take your point on the timing as well. He obviously has to be a little bit careful on this, because you generally, you could do a Jim McGuinness on it, but generally you get one go at your county. And then if it doesn't, you know, if it doesn't work out,
unless you do really well, and then you can come back.
Whenever you want. But if it, say, it doesn't go well, you sometimes maybe think, maybe I should have waited for a few more years. Maybe I should have continued to build my kind of coaching acumen elsewhere. But I just think now he's had his go at Leitrim, did very well. Everyone in Monaghan talks really highly about what he brought to their forwards this year as well. It seems like it is the perfect time for him to come in.
He is, and he's a serious individual, and he'll have, it's just one of those things, like, he's kind of, you know how seriously he'll take it.
Mm.
So it's kind of...
he retired from club after the league this year as well, so at least he wouldn't have to play against any of his players, which might be a bit of a help for Andy Moran as well.
Fingers crossed. And God, if you had someone like Colm involved, look, he's shown it on the last 2-3 years as kind of on the PM show, regular voice, just so insightful. But again, just another incredibly hard worker.
Mm.
Like, I know it's kind of somewhat beyond the fourth wall, but like the amount of work he'd be putting into those slots in terms of watching things and analysing things and going all this. And you might talk about a game for 2 minutes, but you'll have all this work done, that it's just like, it's great, great people.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably, it's a big help, like with any team scenario. If you just have good people at the top, like it's hard to go too far wrong.
Yeah. One as well that we'll touch on with Rachel in a little while, wherever I put the Examiner here, is a good idea by the Examiner, basically on the eve of the All-Ireland Senior Camogie Final. They got the chance to sit down with Sorka McCartan, who's playing for Cork the weekend, and she's going to wear a skirt. So we were wondering, when nearly everyone changed into shorts, whether there might be a few players that would turn out in skorts. It looks like she's going to be the only player on either team that will be wearing skorts as opposed to shorts. In the interview with Sorka, she has mentioned the fact she just feels way more confident in her. Teammates are more than happy for her to wear the skort. She's happy for others to have the choice and to wear shorts, but she's going to wear the skort. But we'll talk about that with Rachel in a little bit. One other thing before we get ready to bring in Ronan Finn on this one. Garnacho, across a lot of the back pages as well, Keith, could potentially be one of those Manchester United players that leave. Who else but Chelsea do buy him? Chelsea need more players.
More wingers, yeah. They love a winger, don't they? It's a strange one, because you look at Garnacho, I'm a big fan of his. I think he can be effective when he's running at people. Should he go to Chelsea? Is it the right next move for him? Not really. They'll probably give him a 12-year deal on ridiculous money and the fire will go out. He doesn't seem like the most highly motivated person in the world right now, because he doesn't seem like he's biting down on the gum shield to stay at United and keep playing. So I don't know. Sometimes I think you have to look past talent and look at the character of the person, and the character of Garnacho doesn't seem like a fit for Chelsea for me. But there's such a turnover of wingers. They've gone and got Jamie Gittins. They've paid not to keep Sancho in the building, yeah, which is absolutely mental. They've sold Madueke and now they want to bring in Garnacho. It just seems it's a wingers of a very similar level just coming and going. And I never liked a huge turnover in clubs. You'd like the spinier team to remain the same for a good number of years, but there's just so many comings and goings that Enzo Maresca is just constantly putting out fires. But I think they overachieved last season massively. I use words like unmanageable, chaotic, you know, mental. Can you imagine how many people are knocking on Enzo Maresca's door on a Monday, unhappy that they're not playing? But
you probably don't know who some of them are.
Yeah, he's doing an unbelievable job, but you know, I don't know where this infatuation with wingers have come from. It just seems like Chelsea, any winger that comes on the market, Chelsea want them.
Yeah, and one last one, Arthur, before we finish up in the papers. Scott McTominay taking pride of place to the back of the London Times today. He's a Ballon d'Or nominee on the back of helping Napoli to win Serie A. He was the Serie A player of the season last year as well. First Scotsman since Ali McCoist to be nominated for the Ballon d'Or.
Some going. I think it's only Dennis Law who's won it, isn't it? Only Kenny Dalglish never won it.
I anyway, don't think he's won it, no.
But it's an amazing achievement. But like, I'm so happy for him. It's just such a nice story. It's like such a, because it could have easily kind of just fizzled out and he kind of went somewhere and went off the radar. But went in, picked a great move, got really fortunate with Conte being there, and just the way they won the league and everything. It was great. I don't know if you saw that match the last day. I don't know whether they were playing Cagliari. Anyway, but they were, I scored such a brilliant goal in the last game to kind of kick it off. And then Lukaku, I know you were talking about Tammy Abraham last night as well beforehand, like it was the same thing. Lukaku just, like, it was Genoa I think they were playing, destroying a fella and just burying it, and it was just party time. But just it, that's amazing. Like, but I don't there's a little bit of revisionism then when it comes back and it's like, oh, but sure, but whatever about Man United and it's all this thing, like they could do it. I don't think it's a given that I don't think this guy's all of a sudden, obviously he clearly is, on the basis of last season, amongst one of the best players in the world by metric of that. I don't necessarily think he was demonstrated being a world class player at Man United in a way that Bruno Fernandes can in that same scenario. So I'd be a little bit wary of that, but it obviously just suits him. I presume that happens. I don't know. Maybe it's kind of, I'm being harsh.
I think he has different attributes. I think Manchester United notoriously will look for a certain style, something that's more pretty, somebody more of the Bruno Fernandes mould. But again, the likes of a Scott McTominay are absolutely invaluable. Those late runs into the box, the engine on him, the walk rate, he's decent in the air. And at the time I did say I wouldn't let Scott McTominay leave the building. I think his walk rate is absolutely invaluable for the likes of Manchester United. But
because his last season at United, he had this spell where he came up with really important goals.
He was the top goal scorer for a while, wasn't he? Yeah, from midfield. And look, I think he's been brilliant. I love watching him for Scotland as well, and his walk rate really sets him apart. And again, probably not the most talented boy in the world, but maximises absolutely everything he has. And I love when a player is probably a little bit shy on the talent front but gives everything, and his walk rate sets him apart. And yeah, looking back now, leaving Manchester United is probably the best thing he ever did, although that must have been a really, really hard decision on his part.